Hello and welcome to Start Your Week. I'm Jacob Jarvis and joining me this morning is the wonderful Alex Andreu. Good morning, Alex.
Morning, Jarv. Isn't it nice that it's light now when we get up to do this?
It really does make a massive change from doing it in the pitch darkness. So before we get started, we just wanted to say a massive thank you to all of you who support us on Patreon already. Things are getting tight in the podcasting world, and we're going to have to rely on you more to help keep the bunker going. We know times are tough, but if you can find £3 a month or more, we'd be eternally grateful. Plus, you'll get episodes ad-free and early and a shout-out on Start Your Week. Search Patreon, The Bunker Podcast, or visit the link in the show notes to find out more. Now, let's get on with the show. So, Alex, first up, let's look at how wrong things are going for Jeremy Hunt and the rest of the crew, let's say, since the budget. Just how badly has this gone down for them?
Well, I mean, it hasn't gone down badly, but it hasn't gone down well either, which is a problem when you're 20 points behind in the polls, right? Because you need big game-changing moments. And what we have is the constant promise that those big game-changing moments will come. You know, it will be the by-election, it will be the budget, it will be the mayoral election. And instead, what tends to happen is that the dial doesn't move. And what's happened in this case is that the dial has actually moved the wrong way. So there's been two polls since the budget, and in both of them, the Conservative share of the vote has gone down in the general voting intention. And there was a slightly more detailed poll over the weekend for The Observer on Sunday, an opinion poll that looked at more specifically how the budget had gone down. And what it found is that actually the message of tax cuts had been overwhelmed by people saying that actually the overall tax burden had been going up. And so there was twice as many people who thought this budget resulted in taxes overall going up, twice as many people as people who thought the tax burden had gone down. And so everything is moving the wrong way. Hunt's net approval rating is moving the wrong way. It used to be, I think, minus 16, which is not great, but it's now minus 22 after the budget. So, you know, every indication is moving the wrong way. There are very few people that had thought the budget was going to make a massive difference. And we know this because there was another 2p cut to national insurance in the autumn statement that preceded it in November, and that didn't seem to make much difference. So, you know, the old Einstein attributed quote about insanity being doing the same thing time after time and expecting a different result. But what happened this time is actually because the discussion has been so lively around the tax burden as a whole, having a budget seems to have had the opposite effect on government than the one they wanted.
Is there going to be any way they can sort of reframe any of this? Because I know that the headlines that have emerged since just seem to have all been not what they'd have wanted. You know, people saying that it's going to be bad for pensioners, then Jeremy Hunt getting called a Soviet and a fiscal drag act on the BBC, which was really quite something. Are they going to manage to reframe any of it? Or is the plan actually going to be just, let's start throwing new things out? And as you say, try and create these quake moments to shift the dial in some sort of way.
I mean, I liked one Tory MP who gave this quote to Politico and said, not good enough to change the polls, not bad enough to stimulate letters calling for Sunak to go. We plod on. That's what it feels like at the moment, right? Yeah. You know, it's like those Rube Goldberg machines. Do you know what I mean? They're named after the humorist Rube Goldberg, where okay, a ball rolls and it knocks over a domino, which starts a pendulum that inflates a balloon, yeah, which lifts a hat, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And you watch until an egg is finally cracked into a pan or something, 24 chain reaction steps later. We yeah know they are heading for defeat. And because Sunak is not brave enough to call the election, we must sit there and watch them cock up the next thing and the next thing and the next thing until finally the egg is fried.
I mean, with the rest of it, with that as well, of watching them just constantly cock up, we're watching them screw up, but we're watching them also just say they're going to do things and then not actually explain how they're going to do things. So, for example, they're screwing up and then not explaining how they're screwing up, which is all getting quite confusing. So the national insurance cut, they've bigged up.
Yeah.
Will we actually find out this week, do you think, how they're going to do that?
We're not going to find out how they're going to do their aspiration to eliminate it altogether, because that's not an actual commitment. If it were a commitment, they'd have to find a lot of money somewhere. It's just in place so that Labour are asked about it and they're told, are you going to eliminate national insurance tax? Only for them to point out that no one is eliminating national insurance tax at the moment. And, you know, the government is just flying loads of kite. But how are they going to fund this particular bit of national insurance? The same way they fund everything else in the budget, which is by spending an imaginary sum of money at some point in the future that is slightly smaller than the imaginary sum they said they would spend last time, which is what fiscal headroom is, the famous fiscal headroom. That's what it is. If I tell you today that in the year 2030, I will be making 150 grand a year, and then I tell you tomorrow that in the year 2030, I will be making 170 grand a year, I just created 20 grand's worth of fiscal headroom for myself. So I can tell you what I'm going to spend that 20 grand in 2030.
Yeah, I might have to start doing that myself to the bank. And
it's ludicrous. It is just ludicrous. I mean, it is to an extent what we all do with the bank when we take out a mortgage, right?
Yeah.
We are, you know, all of it is basically spending future income. Mm. You know, it's all on a promise that we're not going to get sick, we're not going to lose our job, our company's not going to go belly up and all of that stuff, you know. But a national economy is not a household economy. You can borrow money to invest in infrastructure. You can create money to invest. You can have quantitative easing. It's not very easy in an inflationary environment, but you could do it. And so just playing around with tiny amounts, which are fictitious. And the head of the OBR told us last month that these sums are fictitious, because he said the government have not provided departmental budget plans past March next year. Mm. So from March next year, all they're saying is we plan to take in X in taxes and spend Y on services, while giving no explanation of where that additional tax money will come from or where those cuts will fall. They just give a general amount.
Moving on from the budget, so Gove this week, he's due to publish the government's new definition of extremism. Is there any indication of what this will be and what sort of fallout this is going to prompt?
Yeah, I mean, I think that actually gives you the best indication of how the budget went for them. Because they, you know, they spent the weekend after the budget should be spent sort of trumpeting the brilliant stuff that's in the budget. And instead, they spent it talking about trailing a sort of announcement about extremism and what the definition will be, which tells me that as a government, they're trying to change the subject.
Well, when Michael Gove is the cavalry, that's when you know you're really in trouble, when you have to throw Michael Gove at the problem.
Yeah, I mean, listen, in this particular band of brothers, Michael Gove is head and shoulders the most experienced politician they have. So it's probably not that surprising. What is significant, actually, that I saw just before we started recording is that there's a letter signed by 57 victims of terror attacks that have involved an element of sort of extreme Islamist ideology. And they've signed a joint letter asking the government to tone down the anti-Muslim hate, right? Mm-hmm. And calling it irresponsible from some politician to use this subject as a wedge and to equate the vast majority of British Muslims who deplore violence and sort of equate them with extremists. It's really quite a touching letter, actually. I would encourage people to go and read it. It includes, you know, the guy who sort of stopped the attack on London Bridge, you know, who intervened. It includes people who lost limbs in various attacks. It includes people whose relatives died. And what they're saying is basically not in our name.
Yeah. On other scandals which are kind of going on with the government at the minute as well, where they're tying themselves in knots. So Michelle Donnellan is really tying herself up at the minute. So she's been a big focus, but she's actually going to get a bit of a grilling, isn't she, by some peers this week. So what should we expect from that?
Yes, so she's appearing in front of a Lords committee on Tuesday. So that will be quite tasty because I think they will press her on this. I found Penny Mordaunt's defense last week just astounding, where she said, well, you know, Michelle Donnellan apparently could have taken a severance payment of 16 grand when she was sacked as a minister from one job and got another ministerial job 4 days later. She was grand enough to not take that money. So it's all a wash, basically.
Yeah.
Without any examination of the perverse incentives, you know, that might involve a minister or a secretary of state, a minister of the crown, knowing that they can go out there and say whatever about whoever and will cover the tab, which is really quite a significant issue that needs some discussion. I think the Liberal Democrats have actually got this one right. They have written to Sir Laurie Magnus, who is the government's ethics advisor, and have asked for him to look into this. And I think that would be quite useful because he doesn't have to look into specifically this. He could look into generally the practice of sort of picking up legal costs for a minister, when that applies, when that doesn't apply, when a minister goes outside the ministerial brief, as it were, by, you know, tweeting nonsense from their personal account. And there will also be demands to see the legal advice that Michelle Donnellan received, because we know that she got some legal advice before she tweeted out those comments. And if it turns out that the legal advice was bit dodgy, don't do that, she will be in a heap of trouble.
Yeah, I mean, I really don't think you should be able to earn yourself a kind of get out of jail free Monopoly card in government just because you turn down some cash so you can spend some of it. Keeping up with the weird news roundup that we're doing at the moment. So Boris Johnson ended up in Venezuela. They've not kept him, unfortunately. But what was going on there, Alex? And is there going to be some fallout this week?
It is proper weird, this one, isn't it? Because the Foreign Secretary, Lord Cameron, said this was a private visit. And Mr. Johnson texted him, apparently, when he was on his way. But we don't know who flew him there, who paid for the trip, what the agenda was. We know that he met with President Maduro, who has significant questions to answer, especially around the last election in Venezuela. We know that they talked about Venezuela's policy on Ukraine, which seems to me to be a state matter. And we know that Johnson received a briefing at the embassy beforehand and debriefed embassy staff after the visit. So this sounds to me quasi-official. And yet when you ask Johnson's people questions about this, they go, the statement reads, now that he's a private citizen, he won't comment on any of those issues. I mean, if you're acting as a private citizen, then you don't get a briefing at the embassy and you don't chat to the, you know, Venezuelan president about Ukraine policy. It is a very, very strange one, and I think we will see more about it in the coming days.
Finally, on domestic stuff, then let's go do a weird news roundup here. But what is going on with that royal photo? Which I honestly thought it was just some of the kind of uber obsessed royal watchers on Twitter at first, and I thought, okay, whatever, there's something weird with the photo, not interested. Then you look at it and you think, well, whoever has photoshopped this or done whatever they've done with it has really fucked up.
Yeah.
It's quite extreme how bad certain bits of the photo look, isn't it?
Yeah. And apparently 4 agencies now have spiked it. They've sent out what's called a kill notice, which means don't use that photo. It's basically bollocks. And the only agency that's still carrying it, which is, I think, PA, has asked for clarification from Kensington Palace, apparently. So they may well end up spiking it during the day if they don't receive satisfactory explanation. I mean, look, I'm sure photos like that get photoshopped all the time.
Yeah,
I'm sure it's quite difficult to get 3 sort of borderline teenager children being happy and laughing and looking at the camera at the same time. But at a moment when there is so much speculation about the Princess of Wales' health, and at a point where she hasn't been seen in public for over 2 months, to put out a photo that is so obviously manipulated that it will create more questions than give answers is unprofessional and incredibly, incredibly stupid and possibly suspicious.
Yeah, it's very strange. I mean, it's going to get the Daily Mail and the Express and the Telegraph, just they're going to have their front pages sorted out for about 3 months based on this, aren't they?
I mean, and rightly so, right? Yeah. Rightly so, because what were they thinking?
Wyndham Hotels and Resorts makes travel possible for all. Whether it's the long haulers looking for a great cup of coffee, a roomier rest for the on a whim road trippers, or a place to make summer memories with the whole family. No matter who you are, where you're going, or why, with 24 trusted brands to choose from like La Quinta, Days Inn, and Super 8, your Wyndham is waiting. Get the lowest price at WyndhamHotels.com. Restrictions apply. Visit website for more details.
Away from the UK, going stateside, so Biden and Trump's race against each other feels like it began in real earnest over the weekend with those rallies in Georgia. What did you glean from those events?
I found it very interesting because I saw quite extensive bits of Trump's speech. It was fascinating, I think, that there was very little about the usual stuff that Trump attacks Biden on. And there was quite a lot of picking up on stuff he had said in the State of the Union address and really points of policy.
Mm.
I haven't seen that in quite a long time. And I thought, for the first time in months, Trump is not setting the agenda. He is responding to events. He is responding to Biden. And I thought that actually bode very, very well. Because basically, when the moment Biden rang the bell and said, okay, we're now in campaign mode, and used a big sort of occasion to launch that, Trump was on the back foot. And I thought that was fascinating, actually.
Do you think Biden can keep that momentum going? Because he does seem to be really quite boosted by the State of the Union. And as you say, Trump seems a little bit rattled, both by that and also by the mounting financial concerns he has and the amount it looks like he's sort of begging for cash at the moment.
Yeah, and it's not clear what he's begging for, which I thought was quite interesting. He's sort of saying, give me, you know, $5, $10, whatever you can. But it wasn't entirely clear to me if he was asking money for his campaign or trying to crowdfund his legal bill. You know, he's just generally asking for money. And you know, hosting Viktor Orban at the same time. So, an eyebrow has to be raised there, and a question has to be asked if maybe he's asking for money further afield than his supporters in the States. I mean, It's what legal analyst Glenn Kirshner of MSNBC called the new abnormal. He lost the appeal, or rather he was denied an appeal surrounding the E. Jean Carroll $91 million damages. And he lost the attempt to only put down $100 million against the $464 million judgment in his New York fraud case. That doesn't say to me that he's swimming in money, right? All that is saying to me that he's having quite big problems. And I imagine what his lawyers are telling him right now is that his money's not covering their bills, mainly. It will be really interesting. I thought Biden came out fighting in his State of the Union address. I mean, expectations were low, right? Let's be honest. Because of what's going on with Biden, everyone just wanted him to put in a solid performance and sort of not lose his thread and not say something wrong and stuff like that. And he did a heap better than that. It was actually quite a fiery, quite a statesmanlike speech. It really went to the heart of a lot of issues. It set up the election campaign to come in terms of, you know, rights of bodily autonomy for women and all of that stuff. And I think, you know, had Biden been a younger man about whom there weren't all these slightly unfair, in my view, questions about his cognitive ability and his frailty, I think it would have been considered a really good pre-election State of the Union anyway. So, yeah, I think he's done really well.
On some more US-linked news, what's happening with the port that's being built in Gaza? Can you explain that a little bit to me?
Yeah, the whole thing seems to be stalling. I mean, so what they're planning to do is build a sort of floating dock, which can be built very quickly. It's about attaching basically floating blocks to each other. And that's because the Gaza port is a very, very shallow one. So it's very difficult for large ships bringing aid to dock. So that was the plan, but they expected for a ship that was going to carry humanitarian aid to have left for Gaza yesterday, Sunday. And that ship, as we record, is still docked in Cyprus. So I don't know what is going on. The ship is it's called the Open Arms. Keep an eye out for that. It will be a situation that evolves. More generally, the whole negotiations about a ceasefire seem to be stalling. Israel had given this deadline to Gaza. The US had given this deadline to Israel. All of them revolved around the start of the holy month of Ramadan, which started yesterday evening. And still there's no ceasefire. Still there's no agreement. So genuinely, anyone's guess what happens from here on in.
Yeah, I suppose we can just all hope for some progress to happen as quick as possible. Finally, Alex, I actually, because I was sleeping and needed to get up early for this recording, don't know anything about the Oscars at the moment. So could you give me a little bit of a roundup there of what happened? What were your highlights?
Jimmy Kimmel had the funniest burn for Trump, who tweeted obviously some invective about Jimmy Kimmel being the worst person in the world ever and the worst host of the Oscars ever, etc., etc., some rambling MAGA post on Truth. And Jimmy Kimmel simply responded by looking into the camera and saying, "I'm delighted you're up and watching us. Isn't it past your jail time?" Which is brilliant. John Cena was naked on stage, which may be of less interest to you than it is to me and other listeners. It was just upsetting, actually. No one should have that little body fat. There was a magnificent performance of I'm Just Ken, and I'm personally delighted that Divine Joy Randolph won Best Supporting Actress for The Holdovers, because she's magnificent in that film. So that's your summary. And Oppenheimer basically won everything else.
Nice. I'm going to go and Google John Cena Oscars as soon as I can when we've closed this session down.
It'll just upset you. I'm telling you, it'll just send you down to the gym for the next 6 weeks.
Alex, thank you as always for joining me this morning.
My pleasure, Jeff.
Remember, listeners, that you can back us on Patreon. For £3 a month, you'll get episodes ad-free and early, plus a shout-out on the show. And here is Alex with today's.
Big Monday morning thanks to Ian Shell MacLeod, Simon Patterson, Cyril Sierat, and Helen Haywood.
Thank you for listening to Start Your Week, and come back tomorrow for another episode of The Bunker.
Hello, I'm Ros Taylor with news of Oh God, What Now?, the politics podcast that's never going to leave its voter ID at home. On Friday's show, it's 6 months until the US election and Donald Trump is stuck sitting on trial in a New York courthouse. Is he bulletproof or can Joe Biden turn around the polls? In the second half, it's local elections week, but we've steadily taken power away from local authorities. What if we gave it back? And in the extra bit for supporters, is there a right level of ruthlessness in politics? That's Oh God, What Now? With me, Ros Taylor, Raphael Baer, Hannah Fern, guest Nikki McCann Ramirez, out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Start Your Week from The Bunker was written and presented by Podmasters Managing Editor Jacob Jarvis with Alex Andreu. The audio producer was me, Jade Bailey, and the group editor is Andrew Harrison. With music by Kenny Dickinson and artwork by Jim Parrott, Start Your Week from The Bunker is a Podmasters production.